Hey everyone, this is John.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Nintendo, the best Nintendo podcast on the internet. We're back.
It says though Wes's spirit is here. I was in the middle of trying to consume my drink.
I know, right? at least you like mumble through it. Like, try to talk through liquid in your mouth.
Yes. And Wes had his wisdom teeth removed. Yeah.
And then got tragically stung by 8 million bees.
Yeah.
That's why he's not here. He's still recovering from that.
Poor guy. Poor fella. I hope he's all right.
It's not actually bees or wisdom teeth. He's just, he was very deeply affected by the tragic passing of Norm MacDonald. So
that did really happen, and that is truly tragic. That right. is very sad.
But Wes doesn't give a fuck about Norm MacDonald. He's actually just sick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he probably was, like, praying for the cancer to take him.
Yeah. It wasn't just Norm MacDonald specifically. It's everyone. Wes is on cancer's side at all times.
Yeah. That actually, I think that was Norm MacDonald's joke about it, where he was something like, you know, if you die, you kill the cancer, so it's technically a draw. Mm. So that was a very Norm MacDonald outlook to his impending death.
I actually had no idea that he was sick.
Yeah,
I apologize. I was not abreast of the Norm MacDonald health situation.
I think this was probably news to everybody that wasn't in his inner circle of people. Mm. It sounds like, I think he had been suffering from it for over 10 years or something.
Something like that.
And he had just kept it quiet. I didn't look enough into it to even know what kind of cancer he died from. But, that's a tragedy. I've always loved Norm MacDonald. He's so funny. And funny in, like, an unconventional kind of way. His style of humor is just so uniquely his.
Yeah, a lot of times, like, what was his kind of his shtick? Like, the setup was the punchline.
Yeah.
It was kind of the way that he conveyed humor.
Yeah. So, that's kind of a shame. Yeah, you often see him as, like, your favorite comedian's favorite comedian.
Mm.
It seems like the people that love him the most are other comedians. They just see something special in him, and I've always loved his humor.
I always, I liked watching interviews of him on Conan O'Brien, over Conan O'Brien's various shows, because he was just always trolling Conan, and not like,
absolutely.
Not like direct, like, insults to Conan, but like, go in there, like, tell these long meandering stories that were like actual stories. They were all just like really long setups to this like really bad punchline, and it would just annoy the shit out of Conan.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
great.
I remember just thinking, yeah, there was one where it was like he David Spade was like the head guest, and he was like the second because I guess he went up to do some of his stand up, and then he got to join Spade on the couch with him, and he just spent the entire time ripping Spade, just insulting him, just like so trashing him. You know, it's like, he was there with, I don't even remember her name, but she was the actress from that 90s drama, like, was it Melrose Place or something?
Oh, okay.
But the main actress from that had a movie coming out with Carrot Top. And then, he spent the entire time on the couch roasting her for doing anything with Carrot Top. And he's like, hey, tell me. He's like, she's like, you know what the name of the movie is? And he's like, no, I'll tell you what the name of the movie is if it's got Carrot Top. Box office poison. It's just like, oh my God.
Oh, what a dick.
Yeah, he's great. And everyone should go watch the film Dirty Work, which he stars in. One of his few films that he actually stars in. So that is a really, really funny comedy, and I don't think people give it enough credit.
Hmm. When did it come out? Do you know?
I would guesstimate mid-90s, maybe 90s.
So we missed it on the retro show then.
I would think so, yeah. But it's good. It's just really fucking funny. It's a great, great movie. And very much, again, that his style of just, like, misdirects and constantly, like, you know, like you're saying, the joke is kind of built into it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, yeah, he's great.
So, it's a mini show, so we'll talk about whatever the fuck we want. We'll talk about Norm MacDonald for the next 2 hours if we feel like it.
I don't see why not.
But I do have some video games. Okay. Some Nintendo Switch games that I'm going to bring up. As well as maybe a couple movies. If we feel like talking about it.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen a couple of those full-length features.
Oh, yeah? Cool. Mm-hmm.
Some of those moving pictures.
But I wanted to start off with No More Heroes 3, which I finished just yesterday. I rolled the credits, and I actually was delaying putting off.
Blatant false advertising, man. They said there were no more heroes, and then there's suddenly a third one.
Yeah, and then, like, at the end, there's, like, a group of, like, six or seven people. Like, all right, we're all going to go take down the big bad together. Like, look at all these heroes. Everybody's here.
Yeah.
But I rolled the credits. I was actually delaying fighting the final boss because I was just having so much fun tinkering with all the little stuff that you did throughout the world. And they keep like this encyclopedia of all like your side quests and all like your mission battles and like the grades that you get. So if you're really compulsive about like completing everything, and Sherlock is terrified of the balloon he's sitting next to.
Of course. If you were a dog and you had no comprehension of what a balloon is, like, you'd be fucking terrified.
So, on all of like the side quests and collectibles. So basically, like if you're really into like checking off checklists, this game can be really dangerous because there's a ton.
I remember there was like, because I completed the first No More Heroes, and I think I started playing the second, but didn't get that far into it. But I remember there was just like packed with these mini games. There was lots of different mini games you got to play. You know, so like I think one was just, one as simple as like mowing lawns, and you know, some have you playing like Frogger style arcade games and things like that.
Yeah, in the second one, they take a lot more of like the 8-bit style approach to the minigames. But me and Wester talked really briefly about the structure of it because we both played for a few hours the last time that we recorded an official show. And I actually, it's structured a little bit differently from other No More Heroes because in those, you know, you'd have to do your side quests and build enough money to, you know, basically initiate your next mission to pay your entry fee. And then you'd go through, you know, some corridors, fight off some enemies, and then you get to your boss. Whereas in this, they just put everything into the world beforehand. The only thing that you're engaging with once you pay your entrance fee is the actual boss fight. So you're able to sort of pick and choose the things you want to do in order to get the money together to challenge this boss. So you can do things like fight enemies. There are like these nodes throughout the world where you can take on these, they call them defense missions. And there are different types of defense missions where, you know, you're taking on the mini-boss or just hordes of kind of grunt enemies. There's ones where, you know, you get like your little Power Rangers henshin outfit and fight like a big robot or something in space, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
There's also like the missions where, you know, you're picking up trash or you're mowing lawns. Mm-hmm. There are missions where it's kind of like a racing mission where, you know, you're on your bike and you have to go around this track and ram yourself into a lead car so many times. So there's a lot of different ways to build up the cash. And all of it's pretty good fun. And it's cool that it keeps track of all the things that you've done. There's also like little side story missions. One of my favorite ones are these, they call them Coast Guard missions, where it's basically just like a little arcade, like old-timey arcade shooter where, you know, you're like stationary on this turret and like these giant alligators are coming. Like, alligators is a common theme throughout the game. There's a couple of mini-games that involve alligators, yeah.
Do they establish any kind of like location for this game? Or is there like a city, like a real city that it's in? Or is this just like...
No, it's called Santa Destroy. I think it's supposed to be based in like some sort of like Southern California vibe. Yeah. But it could very easily be like a Southern Florida thing too.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, Florida doesn't get enough representation in video games. No, sure. In general.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of, you know, the West Coast and the Northeast. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the Mushroom Kingdom, which is in Springfield, Illinois.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you're just, like, taking down these alligators as they're coming at you in waves. But yeah, I really dig this game. It's silly and it's bombastic and it's so fucking obnoxious. There are many instances throughout the game where you think like a story beat is going in one direction and they just constantly pull up the rug from underneath you. And like, oh no, actually you're going to fight this guy instead. And they mix up the different types of boss fights. Is not like strictly going to be like an action hack and slash game throughout the entire thing. There are going to be boss fights that are requiring you to do different things. It's cool. I highly recommend it. It's been one of my favorite games on the Switch so far this year. It's really, really cool.
Oh, that's high praise.
I was compulsively filling up all these checklists, but there are some other benefits to gathering all these resources that you're doing. There's ways that you are, you know, upgrading your character, you're upgrading like your overall strength and your stamina, and how quickly your super moves will recharge, but just by pumping money into your personal stats. There are also these sort of equipment pieces that you can construct based on loot that you're gathering from completing missions and defeating bosses, and those will do things like extend the amount of time that you are faster than the enemy if you do a perfect dodge. It's like in a lot of action games, if you do a perfect dodge, you know, you slow down time and you're able to execute better maneuvers.
Nice.
But like, oh, and that's actually something I should mention more about the combat. So you can do things like a parry. Like if you're striking just as the enemy is about to hit a strike, you know, you enter this little mini game, which is basically like twist the right analog stick a bunch. And if you do it fast enough, you're able to like do a sword slash. If you're using motion controls, you like flick the controller. If you're just using the pro controller, you're just flicking the analog stick.
Yeah.
And there are like other really cool things in the fight. So you know how you have your wrestling maneuvers. If you stun an enemy and you like get the stars spinning above their head like a cartoon, you do your wrestling maneuver, and those are really cool to keep track of because you are using your beam katana, like in other No More Heroes games. And the more you use it, the more the power depletes. And you can either recharge it by holding a button and like shaking the Wii remote as if you are masturbating, or like just flicking an analog stick, as if you are a lady masturbating, maybe.
Yeah.
Either way, it's inclusive.
It makes sense.
But
I was doing this already.
And that'll recharge. But if you execute a wrestling maneuver, that will give you an automatic recharge, so you don't have to worry about the battery life of your sword.
Okay.
In that matter. I mentioned the super moves. I mentioned being able to lower the cooldown time for your super moves. Those are really great ways to enter a fight. Like, one of the most useful ones is the one you get off in the first place. It's just like a drop kick. And you can basically, like, from one side of an arena to the other, you can close that entire distance by executing a drop kick. And it's a really great way to start a fight because you're immediately on the offensive and you're not, like, dependent on an enemy trying to dodge them. It's like you're entering the fight on your terms. But there's another really cool upgrade that I put on my character that will initiate like an overdrive mode if I execute a perfect dodge while I'm at full health. And that's a really cool way to start out a fight too. But anyway, I digress. Really, really cool game. Have you finished Skyward Sword?
Oh, I have not.
Because when you do, I want to loan you No More Heroes 3.
Okay.
It's really cool.
Yeah, I'm still working through Skyward Sword. It's great, though. I've been running a lot.
How far have you gotten?
Not much further since we last talked. I think I'm at the part... It seems like they broke it apart into sort of two halves, where the first half you're trying to find Zelda, and then the second half you found her, sort of, and then you go on this other quest to find stuff. So I'm sort of starting off that second leg of the adventure. And it's great. I'm actually really, really impressed by this game. Everything I've ever heard about Skyward Sword is sort of like a backhanded compliment or just like that it's a bottom tier Zelda game. And I'm really surprised by that. This game's a lot of fun.
I think there are a lot of really high highs. There's a lot of like really smart, areas in the game with smart dungeon design things. Especially when you get to, you know, you went through the time shift stone section, which is a really cool part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Have you started, so at this point when you're in the second half, you start like revisiting areas you've been to before. Have you revisited the forest area? Have you just kind of...
That's like my next destination, okay. Which I'm supposed to go.
So there are a few things that are kind of annoyances, but some of these things that they've cleaned up in the Switch port of the game, like that character Fi, used to come out all the time and give you just random advice or tell you, hey, we're in a forest now, I wonder what's over there. And then you get to that place and pop out again. It's like, hey, we're here now, maybe now we should go over there. So it was really heavy tutorialized, which was a product of the system it was on. The Wii had a very broad audience, and they were really going after that casual market, which at that point, 2011, had moved on to mobile phones. But that was still the sort of demographic that they were sort of designing around. So you ended up with this very tutorialized Zelda game, which then got cut back on. A lot of those tutorializations got removed when they did the Switch version.
Well, and I feel like you gotta be... I mean, it's not even to say that you're a casual gamer. It's that you're just not even paying attention if you can't keep up with what this game's expecting of you. Because it seems like you can use her to straight up give you objective, to give you hints. I forget what the other... There's like three different things that... It will spell out what you're supposed to do. On top of that, keywords are very present in all of the dialogue you exchange with the people. Like, when you just talk to people, they start telling you things about the world. And, you know, you'll get your main narrative to tell you generally what you're supposed to do. And then usually the next nearest person reiterates that message to some extent. And then on top of that, they give you a fucking sword which points you directly at the thing you need to find and can be toggled to different things they're supposed to find.
Like, right.
The game, I mean, I can see being frustrated by constantly having that fee character hop out to just sort of push you even further along with a game that's already pretty much telling you what to do. Mm. And, I had really never played this game before. And, of course, I played Breath of the Wild. Breath of the Wild is a great game. And I could see where... I was surprised at just how much of Breath of the Wild makes sense in the context of now having played this Skyward Sword game.
Yeah, you can see the fingerprints.
So much of it is all over it. And I think the big thing that makes the two of them different is that Breath of the Wild, in creating that big open world, really split in half what you're doing. Mm. You're sort of either exploring, fighting, collecting and gathering, or you're doing shrine quests. Which are themselves puzzles, essentially doing that puzzly portion of the game. They've really isolated that. Whereas Skyward Sword put it all together. Mm-hmm. You're doing both simultaneously, constantly. There's never really that, that's kind of a drawback, I guess, is that there really never seems to be that part of the game where I just get to go out and just fight off a bunch of boblikins because I want to.
Right, so the sort of open area, so to speak, and Skyward Sword is supposed to be the sky area, Skyloft, and the area surrounding it where you can fly around on your bird. But I think one of the drawbacks of Skyward Sword is that in that sky area, there's not really all that much to do. There's a few side quests here and there. Most of them amount to fetch quests. But there's not really anything to discover. One of the funnest things I found about Skyward Sword was... when you find those goddess cubes on the ground, you're able to send them to the sky, and then you're like, okay, well, now I get to go to the sky and seek out that treasure that I found earlier. So that was a really fun sort of exploration element to it. But, you know, beyond that, going to all, like, the different little islands around didn't really amount to anything.
Yeah, I flew around for quite a bit just kind of wanted to kind of survey the area and see what was out there. And only a couple of them even amounted to anything.
Yeah.
One of them is just simply Beetles resting when he's like not there in the town.
Right.
But I can't do anything because he's not there. Like, what's the point? I mean, I guess I would go back at night or something when he's going to be there. There was like a pumpkin patch place, I want to say, that I found.
Yeah.
Which makes a special potion that's good in certain weather conditions, I think.
There might be some main quest or at least some side quest stuff that happens there later.
If it's the thing, yeah, I mean, because I did a couple of those too. I actually saw that there's like this, I want to say he's like a Dracula looking guy that lives underneath Skyloft.
Yeah.
And that he wants you to like do friendship narrative things. Like, little mini quests that you got to do where it's like so-and-so's got like their sister is stranded because her fucking bird like ate it somewhere. Yeah. And she's like out there and you got to go find her. And it's like, I actually just looked that up online, and I was like, okay, I forget even what the benefits are. Is it that it gives you extra pouches to carry shit?
He'll give you a few items. Essentially, he'll give you like pouches or maybe some money or something. But yeah, the more side quests you get and report back to him with your little friendship tokens, the more stuff he will give you in return.
Yeah, so I saw that the easiest mile marker was like 30, and then after that it was like 100.
Oh, geez.
So I just did 30. I just did enough to get the easiest ones available at the time, which was like 30, so I turned them all in and got the early objectives.
And I forget what the grand prize is at the end. It could be just like anytime you want some money, you can go to him and he'll give you more. Mm-hmm. Or it might be just confusing that with the Ocarina of Time side quest that's kind of similar.
By the way, total creep. This guy looks like a creep, looks like a pedophile, and he's underneath the Skyloft with a child.
Mm, yep.
Like, the town's cool with this? I understand that the town is full of weirdos, but, like, that's okay? Like, I don't know. That just doesn't... that seems sketchy. You know, you would think that, like, yeah, it sucks the princess is missing. Maybe we should do about the basement pedophile.
We can't do anything about the girl that fell to the ground.
Right.
You know what we can do, though? Get rid of the vampire pedophile that lives on the ground. God.
I'm going to get this out of the way, too.
Sherlock, jeez.
Jeez, Sherlock. Calm down.
She really wants out of that chair.
The balloon's coming after him again. Nobody's dead. No, I think... this is, like, the ugliest depiction of Zelda ever. Like, I've never seen an ugly depiction of Zelda until this game. Like, she is always looking fine. She always looks awesome and cool and badass. And this one, she looks like a dope. She looks like the biggest dork. I don't know what to say. Like, you know, this is bizarre. Like, this is a really obscure reference, but I don't know if you remember the Simpsons episode where they got the characters from the X-Files on, and it was like Homer thought that he was seeing an alien or a ghost late at night. Hmm. And it ended up being Mr. Burns, who was coming off of his medication, and he was glowing from radiation from the nuclear plant at night, so he looks like a ghost. She looks like Mr. Burns when he looks like a ghost. It's a very obscure reference. I'm sorry I made it. But, like, what the hell? Like, there's cuter girls at the dorms, you know? Link, what are you doing, guy?
You said Link can do better.
I think, I dare say, Link can do better. Like, is if
I mean, has I mean, I wonder if he attempted just to hit on Impa there a little bit.
Maybe. Hey, I mean, Fee's looking pretty good. Like, I don't know what the deal is there, but I mean, if he could just work some of his magic, I'm sure that would play out way better. I don't know. Gosh, all of the characters look so weird, and it makes the characters in Breath of the Wild that do look weird make more sense.
Mm.
For starters, Beetle. Beetle is like a carryover character from the two games.
Yep.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, Beetle kind of became a mainstay of the series after, I think it was Wind Waker.
Yeah. Who all do you get? You get that kind of priest-looking guy. He's actually a pretty cool character. The priest guy that's like near the school.
Is he the dad?
No, maybe not. I don't think
The dad who's like, my kid went missing. I guess we'll just...
Oh, no. That's a totally different guy. No, the one that I'm talking about, he gives you a lot of, like, early on instructions. He just wears a robe and he stands, like, in the main courtyard area. Okay. In front of the... there's a guy that gives you the shield initially. I forget what his job is. He's, like, the weapons master. He's, like, the school combat expert.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, those they look normal. Everyone else looks just so fucking weird. Like, the fortune teller guy, his head is like a bowling ball, but, like, all of his facial features are, like, the same size as, like, the finger holes would be in a bowling ball. They're, like, all condensed, like, right in the middle of his face. Like, I still can't figure out... There's that character that sells you stuff, like, sells you additional slingshot rounds and
bombs, oh, yeah.
bomb sleeves or whatever. Yeah, yeah. I can't even tell the gender of that character. And the way that it traces you around the shop when you're just, like, perusing items, so creepy.
That guy reminds me of a character in Majora's Mask, the Happy Mask Salesman. Yeah. I guess that character's also in Ocarina of Time, but yeah. It's a very creepy character. He's always got that grin.
And then you choose not to buy something, and just the grin goes away, and he just gives you that death stare.
Yeah.
For a half second before laughing it off, but it's like, you know.
Like, no, that emotion was real. Yeah. Don't try to cover it up.
Yeah, like,
you know, a very visceral reaction, sir.
It's kind of creepy.
Yeah, I don't know. I was never really a huge fan of the Skyward Sword art style. It always was kind of stuck between this sort of a whimsical pastoral art style, but it would never quite went to the sort of Wind Waker cel-shaded, more cartoony look. It was kind of in between that Twilight Princess and Wind Waker art style, where it was trying to like thread the needle right between the middle of it. And, you know, the character models in Twilight Princess, which is also on the Wii and the GameCube, and Skyward Sword was on the Wii as well, they were very much in a similar vein to where, you know, there wasn't really a normal-looking person in the group aside from maybe Link and Ilya, but everyone had, like, these sort of weird features. It was, like, a squished-up face or, you know, like, oh, strange, like... mustaches and other facial features. There are things that were very, like, exaggerated, almost to the point where they were grotesque. But it kind of fit with the art style and the tone of the game because Twilight Princess was like a very dour, somber game. And you kind of expected characters to sort of reflect that tone. Whereas Skyward Sword does not strike that similar tone, but you still are working with the same limitations of the system. So a lot of this, like the character model features get carried over to the next game.
Oh, that would make a lot of sense. And that said, like, the humanoid characters look weird, really wonky. All of the other characters in the world look great.
All the little kiwis and
little
people.
And then all of the NPCs and bad guys, even all of those character designs look really, really cool. The bosses look as simplistic as some of these bosses are, and how easy they are compared to how tough some of the rest of the game can be. Mm. All of that looks really good. Oh, and the character design, I will say. Is it Garahim? Is that the guy's name?
Yeah.
Like, that's the villain from Link to the Past. Like, isn't he the main wizard guy you fight at the end? Like,
oh, maybe.
But he's, like, in the... He's a huge blocky character in those giant robes. I just assumed... It's not at all what I would have expected him to look like in this game. And then there's that... I don't know if it's a... There's a whole race of them. What is Ganon's race of people called?
Oh, the Gerudo.
Yeah, there's, like, the tall, skinny Gerudo woman that is protecting Zelda. Or, like, trying to keep Zelda safe.
That's Impa, and I don't think the implication is that she is a Gerudo in this game. I don't know, but
just that she's like a million feet tall.
Yeah, she's a million feet tall, and you know, a fierce warrior makes her sound like a Gerudo. But Impa traditionally in Zelda games is a part of the Sheikah group of people.
Oh, okay, but all right.
I don't know. I don't know if they ever established what race she belongs to in this game.
Well, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah,
like I was saying, there really isn't a lot of that. Everything feels like it's a puzzle. Everything feels like it's a thing you have to solve as you're going through the game. And the only thing is that it seems like there is a little bit of replay value in that when you discover a new item, you kind of want to trace back again to certain areas. But for the most part, I haven't found anything that's like, you know, I am so glad I went back and did this. Because oftentimes it's just more rupees and things like that.
Yeah, or a goddess cube here and there. But it is kind of nice the way they loop you back around. Once you get to the second half of the game, they loop you back around through some of the same areas. So you're able to revisit things with items you have before. And I think like sometimes that's a complaint that some people have against the game is that it feels kind of limited in scope because they recycle some areas. But like when you revisit, there's a really fun twist when you revisit the volcano area with some of the way that you have to handle your items there. And also revisiting the desert area is the highlight of the game for me. I think that's a really fun section when you get to it.
Yeah. But and that whole area when you're going through the first time, the desert area, is kind of a slog. Like, it's a harsh environment that you don't want to be in. I mean, it's literally a desert, but, like, harsh in that there's not a lot of attractive stuff there. Mm. It's a lot of wide open spaces with brown. So, you know, there is interesting stuff going on there, and the puzzles are just... frankly difficult and long-winded, and then you finally get to the thing and then it just leads you into the mining facility where there is that wonderful thing, like that was a real like mind-blowing, that's beautiful when you hit those things
and the time shift stones
and it everything comes alive, like that is so cool. But there is just so much of that. I feel like that is I spent so much more time in that area just accomplishing all those things. I mean, I never once had to, like, resort to, like, a playthrough or anything to figure it out. And almost always the solution was just, like, what's the last thing I picked up?
Mm.
It was either the scarab flyer thingy or, what do they call it, the push thing?
Oh, the gust bellows?
The gust bellows, right, yeah. You know, it's stuff like that. Oh, and the boss fights are too simple. Way too simple. Like, for how tough the first Lizalfo I fought was... Like, I was like, oh, man, this is going to be brutal. And then the boss fights come, and the boss fights are fucking nothing. Like, there was the one where it's, like, this giant ball that rolls down a hill to come
get you.
I took damage twice in that entire fight. It was so... And maybe that's just, like, we've played games like this a bunch. Or maybe I just committed to memory those sequences where I kept fucking sliding down those hill because I ran out of stamina. How obnoxious that was, where I was like, okay, I'm not fucking this up. But at the same time, like, I don't know. Like, it could have... Could either made them a little more difficult or spiced them up because they were over so fast.
Yeah, I'm not thinking of, just offhand, I can't think of any boss fights that are particularly difficult in that game. I think that there are some really memorable ones, like that one where you have to roll the bombs down the hill against that guy. I thought that was a really fun idea for a boss fight. There's also a couple of boss fights later on that I won't spoil for you. That are fun, maybe not difficult, but at least very memorable.
Yeah.
And I think the contrast of that, and like this is always kind of the thing with Skyward Sword, is that everything positive you can say about the game, there's always like, well, yeah, but then there's also this one thing. You have to fight that imprisoned boss quite a few times, and it's pretty much the same boss every time, except he's got more weak points that you got to hit.
Mm.
And it's not like, as long as it's a bad boss fight... It's just time-consuming and the same thing a bunch of times. You gotta fight Garahim a few times.
Yeah, those Garahim fights are actually pretty cool.
I think those are the ones that require, like, the most, like, skill with your sword. And, like, skills
of observing. And it feels like fighting.
Mm.
You know, it really feels like you're fucking not... using the most recent gadget to do a thing, to make a thing happen.
Yeah, and I think that's something
you actually kind of feel like you're hacking at it with him while he's using his fucking hand to fight you. It's pretty sweet.
I think that's one of the game's strength, is that they do have a really deep consideration for the types of encounters you're getting into, whether it's, you know, you're fighting Gearheim again, or there's a big Moblin troll guy blocking a bridge and you gotta get around him, or, you know, you just like a bunch of Moblins in a camp and you gotta deal with them, and the different sort of, like, with this one's got an electrical sword, so you don't want to use your metal shield and all that stuff. But I want to get back to, like, what you're saying about, like openness versus the sort of lack of exploration when you get down into the ground areas. And it's a really interesting approach for a Zelda game. And I've mentioned this before on previous shows, where we're talking about the sort of level design of Skyward Sword. It reminds me a lot of Majora's Mask, in that, you know, Majora's Mask does have an open field that's sort of like the center of the game, and like the different branches, areas of branch off, lead you to your different dungeons. Whereas in Skyward Sword, as soon as you get on the ground, you've essentially entered a dungeon. And there are puzzles that you're going to need to get to that dungeon. And then, of course, in the dungeon, there are things you have to solve in order to get to the boss of that thing. But rather than having these areas where you're exploring and finding your way through it, it's just an extension of that dungeon to the outside. Which Majora's Mask also does, maybe to a bit of a lesser extent, but I think it's a really interesting way of setting up a Zelda game. I don't know. I really dug it in Majora's Mask. I think it was one of the strong points of Skyward Sword. I would say that Majora's Mask, like, once you beat the boss of that area, it kind of changes the way the outside of that dungeon operates. You know, whether it's you're in the swamp and now the water is not poison anymore, or you're in the mountains and now the snow melts and you can do other things. So the world, like, you felt a bit more of an impact that you were having on the world in that point.
Yeah.
But anyway, Majora's Mask is really great. I really love Majora's Mask. But Skyward Sword,
also a good game. I believe that's up
I think on the retro show in a couple of months.
Yeah, it's a big one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would absolutely recommend this game. And I thought this was like a AAA title. I thought it was like a AAA title. That was like $60 bucks. Mm-hmm. I know when I bought it, it was on a flash sale for $29.99.
Oh, shit.
So I've
That's
seen,
a steal.
Yeah, I've seen, and it's already gone on sale a couple of times. I think that this seems to be an easy one to avoid getting, or to avoid having to pay full list price for a AAA title. And it's worth it. Like, I'm really digging this game. I'm going to see this one through for sure. Because it's... Yeah, it looks great. I don't know. Did they do anything to change graphics on it, or is this kind of what it looked like?
It got up-resed.
Yeah.
At the very least.
Looks really, really good. Again, every once in a while, they kind of wow you with some really, really pretty shit.
Mm.
So, yeah, I'm digging it. Well worth it.
I don't know that...
And Wes was poo-pooing it. Wes was all like, "Bleh, I don't want to play this wonderful game."
It's so funny because Wes went through the cycle of like, "Okay, cool, Skyward Sword, I'm going to give it another shot." And then, like, over the course of a few weeks, it was like, "Oh, I don't know if I want it." And then he just became staunchly against, like, "No, there's no way in hell I'm buying Skyward Sword." And now he owns it and the Joy-Con.
And the Joy-Con.
He yep.
would. He would.
Oh, my God. That huckster. That shell.
Yep.
All right, I got a few more games. I got three games. A couple of them aren't worth spending too much time on. But I talked a bit on the official show about Baldo, the Guardian Owls, which is a bad game. So this game, they featured
it. There was a movie involving dogs called Baldo, wasn't there?
Wes brought that up too. I had never seen these movies, but yes, it's like an anime. I don't know if it's a
Well, if Wes says it's true, I question myself. Maybe Balto's not.
And maybe it's great. He didn't seem to like them. But this is a game, you might recognize it if you saw it, because it was featured on at least a Nintendo Direct. It had like this Studio Ghibli art style, and it was supposed to be like this take on a Zelda. And me and Wes joked about it quite a bit on the official show, because there's a sequence of the game where they give you some bad directions. I might as well break it down again, because it's very early on in the game. You've just beaten the first dungeon and then beaten your first enemy out in the overworld, which was harder than the dungeon boss. But
was it Lizalfo?
It was Lizalfo.
Damn it, those guys, those jerks.
Yeah.
They're gall.
They're such assholes. So... you get to this, what you're doing is that the game gives you this task, like, hey, you just want to get to that town. The girl you're traveling with needs to show you something in that town. Cool, go over there. When you get to the town, there's a guy standing on a bridge. He's a guard, and he's like, hey, no, you can't come in right now. And the girl's like, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. I know another way in. But before you're able to, like, communicate the other way in, he, like, spooks her. So she goes running off, trips, falls down a hole that looks like a well, and you like, you're standing there, and you're like, oh, I guess I'll just jump in after, and you jump in and get the game over, so you're like, okay, no, like, don't jump in, I gotta find a way around. Apparently she's dead down there, I couldn't survive the drop. So then, you know, you gotta work your way around, you find, like, another entrance, but, like, at the bottom of this well, there's a fence that sort of bisects it, and she's behind the opposite side of the fence. Apparently she can't climb over, but there's a door and a key, and she's like, okay, don't worry, I got this all figured out. I've seen this symbol for the key here. I saw it on a manor. There's a villa over that way. And I've seen the symbol for this key in there. But that's locked. So what you need to do is you need to get the key. It's buried under a patch of dirt near the mill in town. We can't get into town right now. So what you need to do is find another well under the bridge, and you'll be able to sneak into town that way. And you're like, Jesus fucking Christ. And that's the game in a nutshell.
Wow.
They give you, like, these three steps.
So go down the well to get a key that's going to help you get another key so we can move this story along.
So, yeah, right. And and it's constant. Anytime you find a new town or a new area where there's people inhabiting it, you get this laundry list of things that you gotta do, and it becomes like, it's like this word salad. And like you were saying about, like, in Skyward Sword, people like repeating these key phrases to you. When you encounter a new quest, either whether it's like a side quest or for your critical path, you always get these like three paragraph descriptions of what you're gonna do, and in every like paragraph there are three or four words that are highlighted as key phrases. Like, oh my god, game, what? And it's so hard to know if you're making progress or not. There are times where I'd play for an hour and none of, like, the things on my laundry list of things to do got crossed out. I just added to it. And it's so disheartening to not make any fucking progress in a video game.
I feel like, I don't know if you even remember bringing this up, but it was so funny when you were talking about, I think, one of the scary movie sequels, when you're like, there's this part where he, like, busts into the house, and the daughter's like, what the fuck's going on? And he's like, no time to explain. And then the guy's like, alien attack!
That about sums it up.
It's, yeah, like, can't you just have someone does that?
Right, right. Like, just anyone that's like, just fucking go there. Just, yeah, fucking go in that direction on your map. You'll find out. Like, good.
Can I just push, like, the left joystick and then a sword comes up that points me to the thing I need to go do?
You know, I never thought it would miss five, but now I do. But basically, like, how this wrapped up, and I ranted about this on the official show, was the, like I mentioned, there's a guy guarding a bridge. That's what spooked the girl in order to, like, where she fell down the well. And she's like, there's another well under the bridge.
How's he feeling about that, by the way? Nearly killed a girl.
He doesn't feel good. It turns out she was royalty. Like, she was the princess of this town.
Oh, so he should be dead.
Yeah. I haven't seen him again yet. Maybe he is.
One would hope.
He's just on a forced vacation. But So when she said, what, you get, like, all these instructions in reverse, where she's like, here's, we're going to work backwards, your starting point is going to be at the end. So, you know, I read this description a couple of times. Okay, starting point, find the well under the bridge. Cool, I'm in a well right now, but we're not under a bridge, there's another well under a bridge. That guy was standing on a bridge, I'm going to go look for a way under it. Not that bridge, there was a well under a different bridge that they hadn't shown you yet. And this is, like, the sort of really poor design decisions that got made in this game, where they're, like, giving you these very detailed instructions, but showing you nothing. It's, yeah, all tell, no show.
So is there any kind of map at all, at least, to work with? Do you get a sense of your space and, like, where you're supposed to explore?
There is a map. There are fast travel points. When you bring up your laundry list of quests, it will give you a little indicator of, like, what sort of direction the quest is in. The biggest challenge that I have had is figuring out which ones to do in which order, because sometimes I'll go after one particular quest and then get there and realize, well, I can't do anything here yet, so I got to go try another one. And, you know, when you think of, like, a Zelda game or something akin to that, there are always these things that mark your progress, whether it's, you know, you beat a boss, you get an extra heart container, you're in a dungeon, you get a new useful item. There's none of that. I've done like three, maybe four dungeons, depending on how you define a dungeon. And most of the time at the end of them, it's like, oh no, here's the next key you need for the next place you gotta go. Hmm. I've only gotten one like HP expansion heart, and it was from a side quest.
Yeah.
So
that's pretty dope.
Yeah, it was overall a game where I never was able to feel like I was ever making any real progress in it. Because it just kept on building on itself. And, you know, I clocked 15 hours. I think that's enough. I think I've gone far enough to know that...
Any sense of how far into the game you are?
The developers said, before the game came out, that it was about a 50-hour game. When I first saw that, I was like, well, okay, that's got to be, like, including all, like, the side stuff you got to do and, like, maybe some optional, like, completionist stuff. They're inflating that number. Like, this is an epic. And, like, after playing 15 hours, like, no, I can totally see this being a 50-hour game. 50
hours. You don't know how many bridges we've made, man. We got some shit going down here. And that means that you could, 50 hours, you could probably watch, like, every Studio Ghibli movie.
Yeah.
Like, all of the main ones made by Miyazaki.
And maybe play Skyward Sword.
And then have some time to clock a little bit of Skyward Sword.
Which you should absolutely do.
Yeah.
And I think, like, the really...
Oh, you know, nitpick. Skyward Sword. What sucks is, like, the very first thing where I was like, what am I doing wrong here? I'm supposed to, like, follow a bird and, like, grab something off of the bird... But then the key that the button that I'm supposed to hit, they didn't, if they explained it, I totally missed this part. But I have to hit a specific button when I'm there to grab it off the bird. And every time I would fly close enough to grab it, I get like a fraction of a second to actually grab it. I just didn't know what button to press. So like it would flash up at the bottom and I couldn't even figure out which button I was supposed to hit.
I don't remember that.
That was an option. It's them... Basically, making sure that you know how flying works before they put you into the big overworld on your bird.
Hmm.
You know? I was like, this is stupid. You don't remember that? Like, there's like some bullies or something that I think they're trying to like, grab something from Zelda.
Yeah, that was near the beginning.
Yeah. Because that's the idea, is that if you get the thing, you get to finish the ceremony.
Yeah.
In which, you know, you get to go back to her quarters, and the dad is there in the corner watching it all. Like a total creeper.
Get your hands out of your robe, dad.
Yeah. All right, no, I digress. So you're saying Baldo is not worth...
No, this is a bad game.
Not worth it.
And actually, like, there were several red flags that went up. First of all, like the price tag was $24.99. And when I saw that, because it was supposed to be this big expansive adventure, it was supposed to be like a take on a 2D Zelda game, and I saw the price, I was like, oh, I was expecting this to be more.
Yeah.
And the second red flag was like the game icon, the game channel. It's just a big picture of the kid's face, like, oh, that is a hideous icon. Clearly did not care to put enough effort into that.
Yeah.
So that should have been a red flag as well, I mean, I suppose, after I had it downloaded. But yeah, this... reviews weren't able to publish until a couple of days after the game was out.
Oh, that's one of those telling things about it.
And it's funny because a lot of the reviews I've been hearing on other podcasts have like talked a lot about the technical issues. Like apparently there's like game crashing bugs and stuff. I have not experienced that at all. Like so far the game, like it might get a little bit framey here and there. Take some frame rate dips, but I've not had any crashes. I've not had any game breaking bugs. I have not gotten stuck anywhere because of a technical issue. I've gotten stuck in places because of some severe design issues. Like the dungeons in this game are very poorly built.
Yeah.
Just in terms of, you know, how they lay out the rooms and how they hide things that are like switches to open doors. One, me and Wes were playing before we recorded. I think it might have been after we recorded the official show, and I was going through dungeon at the time. And there was a, like, in Zelda style, there was a door blocked by some bars, and you had to find the switch to open it up. And the switch was actually underneath, in the corner of a room, underneath a group of bushes, where you had to chop the bushes, and there underneath was a switch. And like, oh, yeah, cool, so. Great, thanks, game. Like, why bother putting, why don't we just fucking have the switch? Fuck you, game. Fuck this game.
Well, I mean, for what it's worth, so it says this game came out August 27th, so it's been a few weeks. It's got literally two reviews from professional sites
on
Metacritic right now. So they can't even establish a score for it because there's not enough actual critics that have reviewed the game. Like, it has 55 reviews from actual people. And it's, like, a 55 out of 100.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, in video game terms, that's a very bad game.
Yeah, that's abysmal.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I don't know what the deal is with this game. It seems like the... Whatever their intentions were, they missed the mark.
Yeah, and it's baffling because I had read that this game was, like, 15 years in the making. And, guys, you should have played some Zelda games... Yeah. In those 15 years, because you would have gotten an idea of how to construct a progression system of quests and a dungeon. Jeez, I feel bad like dragging this game over the coals because it's their first game. But play some other video games while you're making your game; you'll get some ideas.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
So, you got any other games on tap?
I have actually another game to talk about. It's not a Nintendo game though.
Okay,
It's a PC game. I haven't played one of these in a while, so I figured I'd get a new-ish one and try it out. And it's a game that I've seen a lot of really good reviews for called Prey.
Oh, sure.
It's P-R-E-Y. Mm-hmm. It is a Bethesda game. And
Wes would be so happy.
Yeah, I love the shit out of it. This game's great. So what is it like? So Bethesda has this weird reputation of always having games that are so glitched out they can't be, like, you know, that they're so broken.
It, like, becomes part of the charm that their games are janky as fuck.
Yeah. And in this one, I think, is one of the first times where they were ever like, no, but let's make it inclusive to the game itself. Let's make, rather than having the jank be on the outside, let's make you feel like you're in control of the jank.
Interesting. If that
makes sense. So what it is that it's a, it's very much a, You're trapped on this space station, and you're trying to escape or trying to uncover this thing while... first and foremost, Bethesda typically makes action games. This is a horror game. This is actually a horror game. A survival horror game. But they give you these things that are designed to make you break your environments to an extent. Like, for example, they give you this what they call a glue gun, a glue canister, G-L-O-O, and it shoots these big, like, I don't know what you would call them. Just they look like big marshmallows. And they're designed to trap enemies. But what you can also do is literally shoot a row of them up the wall, and you've just made a ramp.
Huh.
So, like, literally the first main area you go into that has a lobby and a couple of doors you could explore, you can just start right there and break the game and make a little ramp and go to the second floor, which you're not able to reach with any other abilities, go through a door, and then fight an endgame boss.
All right.
You know, or like something that's meant for someone that's played the game for 15 hours, 20 hours to get to that point where you can have that fight, you know? It's just really, really cool. It makes you want to poke and prod everything in the environments. Also, one of the neat things about it is one of the earliest enemies you encounter are called mimics. And mimics take the shape of any random object in your environment. And they're always spawning. They're always there. So, like, if you're walking down the hallway and you see, like, a trash can in the middle of the room, you should probably be like, what the fuck is that?
Why would someone put a trash can in this room?
That wasn't there when I went through the hallway last. And I bet you it's a mimic. And if you were to walk up there and try to explore and grab whatever's in the trash can, it would immediately jump at you and attack you. You know, it's so great. And they still get, like, no matter how cautious you are and careful you are, the game always finds ways to get you with these little things.
So it's like the game persistent? Like, if you leave a room one way and you come back later on, it's going to be the same way you left it, unless there's a mimic?
Yeah, yeah. Everything's persistent. And you travel into different environments. It is all one big space station.
Mm-hmm.
So there are different areas. It's not like you can't just walk continuously from one end of the thing to the other. There are some load areas. By the way, there is also a zero gravity environment. You can leave the space station and go into outer space. Very, very cool. But yeah, like you're saying, if I shoot the wall ramp up, that's going to be there forever. Unless I choose to break it down, and you can break those down if you want. There's these things that, like, the way that it works is there's something called neuromods. And neuromods are what this whole research station has been kind of working on. And what they do is you inject them into yourself, and it's basically alien DNA or something like that. And you start to gain the powers of the aliens. And they give you all kinds of neat things. It could be stuff as simple as hacking. Oh, like, every door that's locked has a little hack icon at the bottom right. So if your hacking skill is high enough, you can just simply go in and hack it.
Hmm.
With these little mini games and break through into areas you shouldn't have been able to achieve. But it's also a scaling thing. There's hacking levels, so you'd have to invest a lot of your neuromod points into that at the expense of other stuff. Things like strength or ability to sneak. There's also, there's like a million different little things, but again, another, just to kind of focus in on what it means to break the game. You can also use the, everything in the environment that you have can be converted down to essentially resources, parts to build things. So one of the things is basically like alien scraps. If you kill an alien, they may have some stuff on them, including these scraps that are like, I guess, part of their, I don't know what you call it. Like they would be used in their medical testing and stuff. So with those and a couple of other common items that are found around that can be converted down to these base elements, you can make more neuromods if you have the recipe to do it. So one of the things early on that you can do is if you just know where it is, the second I realized that this existed in the game, I was like, I'm stopping what I'm doing and I am going to sneak to this place and get this thing because wow, this is going to fuck everything up. So I do that. And then like after only a couple hours of gameplay, I'm manufacturing the neuromods themselves that are going to make my character insanely strong.
Huh.
Everything about this game just feels like it's designed to be broken in an intentional way by a savvy game. I haven't really seen this implemented in a... It is, to an extent, in just the way that you explore, it is kind of a, dare I say, a Metroidvania-style thing, where you find a new weapon or a new item, and that's going to help you explore. But I don't think the game really plans on you to sneak to find the recipe to make neuromods, blast out a bunch of neuromods, and then suddenly have like level 2 sneak, level 2 weapons damage, and like an extra point into hitting an enemy that is unaware of your presence. So I had like a 500 times multiplier on what just the security guard shotgun should do, and I was just taking out everything in one hit. It's so insanely powerful. Like, there's 4 levels of strength, like where you pick up, where you can move objects. Mm-hmm. And there are some areas where a door is simply blocked by a bunch of heavy things. And they'll say, you know, if you want to pick it up, it's like a level 3 weight and you can't do that. What you can do, invest the 1 point, pick up a level 1 heavy thing, throw it at them. And the physics in the game will knock the pile over.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah. There's a ton of just fun little ways. Oh, you find the corpses of the... So when you... get to the security guard. There's these security guard stations throughout the facility. Every single one of them has a computer that lists where everybody is in the facility. There's like 200 or so scientists, officers, people on the thing. And it'll tell you if they're alive or dead. And like almost all of them are dead. So it almost becomes like this big Korok seed Easter egg hunt to find all of the corpses. And again, every time you find a corpse... they've got really cool stuff on them. They've got, the game is very much like a run around and just grab everything kind of game. Oh, yeah, there's inventory.
Logan's grave robbing.
Yeah, I mean, they're all dead. yeah, there's inventory Tetris. There's all, they packed so much fun into this game. It really is great. The only thing is that if you're really not careful, you can get iced. You can die real easy in this game. Which is true. It's a horror game. It's a horror game before it's any kind of combat game. So yeah, you get it. And as far as weapons go, you get your wrench, you get a pistol, and you get a shotgun. Everything else there is can be a weapon, sort of, but it's a tool first. It's whatever it is. It's designed to be a tool. So yeah, this game. Oh man, it's so much fun. I really enjoy it. It's a game from 2017. This one's been out for a while. So I'm just sort of digging into a game from the past, really. But if anyone's never gone back and played this Prey game, I would totally recommend it. If you're looking for a first-person game with some really strong horror elements and just fiendishly clever puzzling goes down in it. Of puzzles you create for yourself. Not even like you have to solve a thing. It's just like you get to constantly find ways in which you're going to break the mechanics of the game.
Cool.
So that's all I got.
I do have 2 more games. I get through really quickly. I downloaded Far Lone Sales.
Okay.
Far:Lone Sales. It's a game that I really liked. I definitely recommend that one. There's a sequel coming out next year, which is why I downloaded this one. I never played it before. But basically, it's a sort of a walking simulator to an extent, but instead of like actually walking, you are in this big tank type of vehicle. And most of the gameplay revolves around maintaining that and clearing obstacles out of the way so you continue to move forward. And it actually reminded me a bit of Affordable Space Adventures. And a lot of what you're doing is, okay, I am in my vehicle. I need to put some fuel into the engine. The engine's getting too warm. Let me hit the switch in order to vent the steam. That'll also give me a speed boost. Okay, now I need to move fuel from my other storage areas down to where it's closer to where it's, my fuel resupply goes into. Okay, and now there's enough wind. I can see that the wind is blowing on my little flag. I can like lift up my sails so I can save some fuel and keep moving with the sails. And then, oh shit, I can see fuel canisters lying on the ground. Let me stop everything, run out and grab those, and run back in real quick. Or sometimes you have enough time to drop like your little magnet item that will, or vacuum that will pick them up for you. So it's a lot of that sort of like micromanagement to just the operations of your vehicle in order to keep it rolling forward. And then there are beats in the game where it's, okay, well now there's something in your way, so you have to jump out and solve a little puzzle, like hit some switches in the correct order in order to raise a barrier or drop a bridge and keep on rolling forward, that sort of thing. So it never gets super complex in what it's asking you to do, but it's always just like really pleasant, especially when you like overcome something to where your vehicle get stuck behind something, and you figure out like the order of things you got to do, and you're able to move forward, and then you get like a little segment of like 2 minutes of just kind of like rolling along through this really like a pastoral wasteland environment, because like the world has ended for some reason. But And it's funny because you end up, because you're doing so much to maintain this thing, this ship, you are, like, you build up, like, this relationship with it. And it kind of becomes the second character of the game. And then there are parts where, like, if you use a certain type of fuel, it will, like, give you more speed, but also part of your vehicle will catch on fire. So you got to get the fire extinguisher and go put it out. Or maybe there are parts where, you're going through a storm, you get struck by lightning, so you have to go and put the fire out and then get your welding thing and put part of your ship back together so you can keep on moving forward. And really, there's like...
So it's all like +2 to 1 thing, but -1 to another. And
right.
You kind of got to do a juggling act to keep it ship shape.
Right, right. And as far as I know, like, there wasn't really any penalty to letting it stop doing all the things you need to do to fix it up and then continue forward. But you wanted to, like, keep all the gears turning. Like, it does a really good job of making you, like, feel like, okay, if I just, like, do these other things really quick, I can dump some more fuel in and I can keep going. I don't have to stop. Anyway, it was a really cool game. It only took 2, maybe 3 hours to get through.
Really? That's not bad at all.
Yeah.
A multiplayer element to it?
Not that I'm aware. That would be fun, though. Yeah. A lot like Affordable Space Adventures, where the fun part was like, okay, well, you do this and I'm doing this other thing. Nobody fucking honk the horn. Don't anybody do it. You're gonna fuck us up.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
I'm really looking forward to the sequel. I thought that was really fun. The other one that I got, another end of the world game. It was called Wasteland. Hang on, I wrote that. Golf Club Wasteland.
Oh, okay. I didn't look into it, but I saw that title and I was like, that's a title.
Yeah, and I saw the trailer for it and I thought this looks pretty cool, and I probably wouldn't have gotten it if I wasn't having such a bad time with Baldo. I needed something else to break up some space, because like, okay, I need a couple days away from this. Maybe if I take a couple days off and go back to it, I'll have a new perspective on it and things will start to make more sense. That didn't happen. But Golf Club Wasteland, it's another really short game. It only takes a couple hours to get through, if that.
Yeah.
And much like a golf game, you're playing through this course, and it is, I think it's 35 holes, and then you're done with the game. And then you can like do like a challenge mode where you're trying to like lower your score, but I don't think it is worth doing that, because they set you up on this course, and it's entirely on a 2D plane. So, and the sort of mechanics that it gives you to work with are so minimalistic that, even something like I was going to make a comparison to Golf Story. Golf Story has a lot of mechanics. that gets you a lot of nuance to a golf game. And
is this almost like just like a trajectory, like geometry game, like a Worms Armageddon, or like literally like Ball King? Like my favorite mobile game, which is free if anyone wants to play it, is called Ball King. It's a basketball game, and literally you're just shooting arced shots with a basketball. It's got nothing to do with basketball, really. It's just a fun, really mellow, chill kind of game to play. Like sometimes these are fun.
Yeah, so it is just kind of a line up your shot and take your shot. You know, there are a lot of hazards in the way.
Better than Mario 3 golf? The Mario 3 minigame?
Yeah, just barely, though. just barely. Yeah, because without any sort of nuance, like, a lot of times you're just kind of taking shots blind. Like, you do, like, control the sort of, like, elevation that you're hitting your shot, and you're also the amount of power you're hitting it with. But you're basically just doing it with an analog stick and the A button, and that's as mechanically demanding as it gets. So
another mobile game that's like this is called Lonely One. I would absolutely recommend.
Yeah.
Just saying. I love these styles of games. They're so therapeutic.
I think that the frustrating thing is that, you know, when I watched the trailer, I thought this was going to be a sort of like trick shot mini golf kind of thing where, you know, you're hitting off walls and like into little pipes that's going to dump you off right next to the hole. And there is some of that in there, but so much of it is just kind of playing golf but sort of nibbling at the edges. You don't really ever get to drive the ball very far. And it gets most frustrating when you're working like up a vertical building and the hole is at the top of the building. You have to work your way up these platforms in order to get up there. Thankfully, there is a mercy rule on every hole. If you go so far over par, it's like, hey, you just want to skip this? And there were two times I was like, yes, I definitely want to skip this. One of those two times was just like working the ball up the platforms, and you really have to arc it so it doesn't roll on you. Which, you know, when you're trying to give it enough power to move that up far enough, it's hard to maintain that control to maintain the arc that you want to have. But the other one was another one where you had to work your way up a building. But in order to even get there in the first place, you had to go through this broken window. And once you were through the broken window, you had to arc it just enough to where it wouldn't roll, because on the other side of this very short building was an elevator shaft. And you just, if you didn't arc it just right, you would either like bounce off the edge of the window, or you would roll it too far and go right down the elevator shaft into an even worse position that you were in before.
So is it pure geometry, or is there like a sweet spot that you have to hit? Is there like that thing where the bar goes up and you have this much power and this much accuracy, or is it
pure geometry?
Again, these games, I really do. I mean, this sounds like this could be fun for me. It sounds like you're not really particularly hot on this one.
I mean, maybe you would like it. Maybe it's like $7. It's not super expensive.
Yeah, it sounds reasonable.
But maybe it's something you would get a lot out of. I just found it way too frustrating to have so little control.
Are the environments nice?
Yeah, I think they do an all right job. They are really impressed with the sort of story and lore that they are trying to communicate. There's like this voiceover and like really ambient music. The sort of premise of the game is there was a devastating plague on Earth. Shit. And people had to, the wealthy evacuated Earth and moved to Mars. Earth became this toxic space where you couldn't even breathe the air. And people would be tourists. They'd be tourists on Earth. They put on their spacesuits. They go to Earth and they play golf.
No. So yeah. They just have like a skyloft up there with an ugly princess.
Yep. She's 14. You leave her alone.
Maybe she'll grow into that wonked out face of hers.
You didn't like the big sideburn braids?
No, what is... Jeez. Everything about this woman is just a mess. All right.
That's it. Those are the games that I had.
Nice.
You saw some feature-length films?
Yeah, I did. I'm trying to think of the ones that I've seen recently. I actually have a movie night, so I watch at least one movie every weekend. Every Monday.
Right.
So the ones... Well, one that stuck out for sure, which I loved, was called Pig.
I don't know this one.
It came out maybe a month or two ago. It's got Nicolas Cage in it.
Okay.
And the premise is he is a guy that is a loner that lives out in the woods. And he has a truffle pig. You know, a pig that sniffs out truffles. And he's living in rural Oregon.
Did Wes talk about this one? This sounds really familiar.
Oh, he may have.
Okay. Go on.
Oh, wait, no, he was talking about, I mean, I'm not sure. I feel like he was maybe talking about another Nicolas Cage movie. I don't know if he saw Pig.
Maybe it was like called Badger or something. I don't know. Nicolas Cage makes so many movies.
Maybe. Well, let me keep going with the story. Like, so basically, right, like, someone comes to his house and steals the pig from him.
Okay.
And then he is sort of set off on this adventure to go find who stole his pig. The initial setup leads you to believe that you're about to get into a really formulaic John Wick or Taken scenario where you're going to go see Nicolas Cage beat some people up and, you know, shoot some people in the face and then get his pig back or something. And it does not play out like that at all. It's so refreshing. What you get is a really intense character drama about who this guy is and why he lives in the woods and why he cares about this pig, what it means to him. He wasn't always living in the woods. He once he was a well-respected person prior to this. And it's about what happened in his life that made him feel as though he needed to leave it all. And you just end up with this really heartbreaking narrative this journey that he goes on. And it's great. It's so good. And it ends up, I don't want to spoil it too much, but it ends up being about something that's very high-minded, something that is very oftentimes pretentious. A sort of subset of elite culture. I think it's a truffle pig. It's about food. It's about people that look too highly upon culinary stuff to an extent. But at any rate, yeah, I absolutely love this just for the fact that this is an earnest and honest film. Nick Cage is great. He's actually very subtle. He doesn't really say a lot. It's a very brooding performance and a very emotive performance from him where he doesn't need to say anything. You kind of read just so much into the way that he behaves. Absolutely love it. Would strongly recommend it. It's got like a 90... I think it's the best reviewed film he's ever been in.
Oh, shit.
It has like a 98% on
better than Con Air? How dare they?
Yay, that's... I mean, and you got a cast that's got John Malkovich, you know...
As the pig.
No, sorry,
Con Air.
Yeah. You got John Cusack in the mix right? You got Stevie B, you got Buscemi up in the mix, right? You know, it's a wonderful cast. I digress. That was really good. I also saw a Netflix film called Gunpowder Milkshake.
I saw that one too.
Which very much is that Taken shit.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's, to me, and the other thing is really fucking kitschy. It's like if Wes Anderson made a fucking John Wick movie, you know? You know what I'm talking about? Like,
yep.
But that all said, it's not a bad film. It does what it does exactly what it's supposed to do.
A bit more kinetic than a Wes Anderson film, but yeah.
Right. What'd you think of it?
I thought it was inoffensive. I thought it was fine. Yeah. Yeah, like kind of like your standard like killer assassin lady finds compassion for someone she sees as a sort of like a reflection of herself, and then it turns into okay, well, instead of trying to carry out this mission, I'm going to now protect this kid.
Yeah. I don't remember the actress's name, but I know she was in one of her earlier. Oh no, it's Gillen.
Karen Gillen.
Karen Gillen. Yeah. She was in a really good of all of the famous shit she's been in. She was in a obscure horror film from like maybe 7 or 8 years ago called Oculus.
Oh yeah.
Strongly recommend it. Hmm. It's good. It's a gross out horror film. There's some very gory shit in it and it involves eyeballs and stuff, as you could imagine from it being called Oculus, but it's also a really, really good horror film. Hmm. Really, really, some clever twists and turns along the way of that one. And it's small cast. It's like her and her brother or something, as I recall. It was good.
Okay. Anyway, I don't think there was any like particularly cool standout action sequences. Like
there's just too many of them, if anything. Mm-hmm. It all kind of blends together. The car chase wasn't particularly meaningful or good. Mm. Like there's the one where they're in like the underground thing and they're in the parking garage, I think. I was like, yeah, whatever.
There's the one action sequence where she was like in the hospital and her arms had been paralyzed.
Yes.
So she like have like these guns taped to her hands, kind of like noodle arms flopping around. It was just silly.
Oh yeah, with those other three like meathead assassins.
Yeah,
You know, it's whatever.
You never, of course, in any sort of like these action movies, there's always this assumption that the hero is going to be fine. Like they're gonna make it out of there okay. But you never really felt any sort of, like, real danger. You don't know how many, like, floods of goons are going to send out our group of heroes that the goons don't really stand much of a chance.
Right, yeah. Again, that's sort of the whole... The need to justify these kill counts in these kind of movies is a bit absurd. Mm. It's a bit much.
But I saw a movie.
What'd you see?
I watched Reminiscence, which is the new Hugh Jackman movie. And it was released in theaters on HBO Max simultaneously.
Oh, right. I'd heard about this. What'd you think of it?
No, it was bad.
It was bad, huh?
Yeah, it really was. So
did he have blades between his knuckles?
He did not have knife hands, no.
Dang. That's all right. You know, that's a big thing about him now.
So the general premise, and they do a lot of this sort of world building, and they do a lot of it through narration, which I think is to the movie's detriment. It reminds me of sort of a Blade Runner situation where... The tone of the movie would change drastically if you were kind of left to figure out what exactly had happened in the world rather than having someone explain it to you in a voiceover. They do a lot of telling you that, you know, global warming had gone rampant and the oceans were starting to overtake a lot of the coastlines. It takes place in a flooded Miami, and they're using like these levees and water pump systems in order to keep the ocean at bay, but a lot of the city is at least partially underwater. It's a very wet movie. There's a lot of people like moving around in boats, like they're in Venice. When you see people like walking in the streets, people are always like walking in knee-deep streams of water. There's a sort of a political class, a social economic class system that's built up where, you know, the rich people are able to afford land and live on the land, and everyone else is supposed to find ways to exist in these areas that are flooded. So at some point there was this war, and Hugh Jackman, whose name escaped me for a second there, and I can't remember her name, Thandie Newton, I think is her name. They're old war buddies, and they now are in this business together where you are able to sort of relive these past experiences in your life through the power of your own mind. They give you like this, they put you in this pool of water, in this tank, and put this magic device on your head, and you sort of like get hypnotized into reliving these situations in your mind again. And like it's experiencing them as if you were still there. And so that's kind of this general premise of the world setup. And there's a lot of dialogue. Way too much of the dialogue is sort of referencing back to things you had not seen, like, oh, this and the war and that with the land barons. And like this sort of world-building setup stuff, which is just better off if you were left wondering about what made the world the way it is. Because a lot of it is just infer, like, hey, the oceans rose. I wonder how that happened. Probably the way it's happening right now. And if too much dialogue just about the war without really ever telling you exactly what it was. Like, if you can just mention that one time there was a war and they were in it together, and now you understand more of their relationship, it's fine. We don't need to keep hearing about this. But the sort of movie itself is this film noir sort of set up, complete with a femme fatale, where Hugh Jackman meets this woman, they have this this relationship, and then there's this moment of perceived betrayal and his journey to figure out what it is that happened to her, if she is still alive. And it's a lot of very heavy-handed dialogue. It's stuff that thinks it's more high-minded than it is. I struggle to think of a comparison if Terrence Malick had made the Maltese Falcon.
Okay.
Just fucking awful.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, it's just a really simple premise. I had this relationship with this woman. She is gone. What happened to her? And then it just gets way too contemplative about this really simple setup.
Yeah, I think that's Malick's thing, is that he loves to have these just long-winded sequences of not a lot happening and people just thinking about things.
Right. Right. People feeling ways.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Actually, it makes me think of two other movies I did see. Not to just ramble on about movies.
No, totally fine. Don't watch Reminiscence.
I rewatched, and this is literally what we did watch for our movie night, a movie called Body Heat. Have you ever heard of Body Heat?
I have heard of that.
Yeah, Lawrence Kasdan made it. I want to say it's in the early 80s. It is a sort of a then throwback to film noir. It's kind of strange to think about. This movie is, oh my God, it's like 40 years old. But it itself is referencing cinema made 40 years prior to it. So it's odd in that, but yeah, it's also set in Florida. It's very much a Florida film. It's set in Florida during a heat wave, shot in location. It's great. Lawrence Kasdan is the writer of Empire Strikes Back, specifically known for having written the dialogue between Han and Leia. So he is very, very good at writing dialogue. I guess romantic dialogue. I don't know what you would say. Very seductive dialogue.
Combative, even?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's kind of part of it. There is sort of a verbal sparring that goes along with the way that he has men and women who are attracted to each other communicate. And it's great. Yeah, it's very much... It's kind of like the movie Double Indemnity. I don't know if you remember that one. That's an old film. The premise being that, like, woman has an affair with a man and tries to convince the man to kill her husband. And a lot of it is just sort of watching... I believe Kathleen Turner is the main actress in it. And I believe it's William Hurt is the guy that she's trying to seduce and convince him to, you know, murder her husband. But you're kind of watching her whole story just unfold. I've seen this movie 4 or 5 times in my life. I love it. But every time it's fun to go back and see what you think she knows versus what's really happening. Because this is one of those performances that she's giving where it's a constant misdirection. She is the prototypical femme fatale. She's the smartest one in the room, but convinces everyone that she's the dumbest kind of thing. Really great to watch. Super steamy. I mean, this is a movie that has got a lot of fucking in it. on top of it, it is simultaneously this super classy looking noir with this gorgeous soundtrack that just has a lot of these two fucking.
The way you set up that sentence is why I laugh at it. The way you set up that sentence, I thought like fucking was gonna be used as an adjective. I thought there's a lot of fucking shooting in it. Like no, there's just a lot of fucking in it.
Yeah, they go at it. They are yeah. You would think there was a quota they were trying to hit or something. No, it's great. It's really, really good. There's not a lot of people in the cast either. You really got basically about 5 or 6 meaningful characters that have a good chunk of dialogue. Love this movie. If you wanted to see a good noir film that wasn't made in the 40s and shot in black and white, and that's not Chinatown, this is about the best you're going to find. I love it. It's so very Florida. Being from Florida, it's nice to see a movie capture us.
Yeah.
You know, on the big picture.
Film noir is kind of a funny sort of genre, I suppose.
That's the thing about it. It's an aesthetic.
Yeah.
You can make any kind of movie a noir movie, really.
Right. And it is most often associated with sort of like a hard-boiled detective.
Yes,
like it's going to be a very simple premise. We have our hero. He's going to figure out this conspiracy or this situation that's happening. And there are modern ones, like you're talking about, Body Heat, relatively modern movie like Brick.
Modern. And that's like, yeah, that's like noir worship, practically.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes like this genre is... played for laughs, like
yeah.
You know, like a movie, the deep cut, like Lucky Number 11, which is a movie with Bruce Willis and Josh Hartnett, Lucy Liu, Ben Kinsey, and oh my God, Morgan Freeman, Jesus Christ,
yeah,
I forgot Morgan Freeman's name.
You have missed a page.
but yeah, tremendous cast, kind of an overlooked movie, but it's a film noir movie, but a lot of the conventions are, it's also a comedy. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's an interesting genre because of how malleable it is.
Yeah. And I think that it's a lot of high contrast, black and white imagery or light and dark. It's the use of light and dark. It's the angles. It's, I think there was that, where's that famous politician that said of pornography, I know it when I see it.
Yep.
It's sort of like the moment you see a noir thing, it's shadows cast across Venetian blinds, mm-hmm. you know? It's sharply cut angles of a film, Dutch angles. Seeing how things are framed, watching someone walk into a scene by just simply seeing their feet and not their whole body. Like, just there, it's a really artistic style of filmmaking. And a lot of the greats cut their teeth on it. Like, there's a guy, Carol Reed, made The Third Man, fucking incredible. Stanley Kubrick's first two feature-length films that he made were film noir, called The Killer's Kiss and Killing. Orson Welles.
Orson Welles, yeah,
maybe. Orson Welles had made a ton of film noir. And that's like all the classic stuff too. Like, there have been it feels like every once in a while someone wants to revisit the genre and use.
We mentioned Winston Brick. That was
Ryan Johnson.
Ryan Johnson, who of course is now like fucking making every movie.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I couldn't pick out a specific scene that used it, but I bet you that there's tons of the conventions of noir in that Gunpowder Milkshake. Mm. You couldn't escape some of it. It's just so prolific. But yeah. So, and again, that's a movie that's designed, aesthetics that's designed to sell, like, hard-boiled movies. So if you've got, fucking Blade Runner. Blade Runner is sci-fi noir.
Yep.
But man, if you're telling me Reminiscence is just like, well, the one, well, I guess that was my first point I was going to try to make about that is one, noir is really not a good platform to tell pretentious things.
Hmm.
It really is at its best when it's sort of used to accent scenes and to tell a good story. And then two, it reminds me of another film I watched recently called Quiet Place 2, Part 2.
Oh, nice. I haven't seen that yet.
You haven't seen it yet?
No.
Okay. And that ties into the element that you were saying where if you're already in the post-apocalypse, do we need to keep talking about what happened?
Right.
You know? Right. It's sort of like... Children of Men doesn't belabor the point.
Children of Men is so fucking good.
It just tells you. God. It's just like, kids can't be born anymore.
Let's take just one second to reflect on the year that was 2006, because 2006, No Country for Old Men, you get There Will Be Blood, you get Children of Men, and I think Children of Men far and away holds up so much better.
Yeah.
Like, Children of Men is so fucking good. Anyway. And those other two movies are amazing. No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood, those are great films.
Yeah, they are.
Anyway.
So that was what I was saying about A Quiet Place Part Two, is that it's very much, when you see the first one, you're in the aftermath. They're not really, they're not concerning you with how these things came to be or why they're there.
Yeah, like if someone new enters the scene, you don't have to have a conversation about the thing that they all experienced together a while back.
Yes. There's no one running in saying Alien is Ack. It's good. And then, so Quiet Place Part Two, it didn't get the best reviews. I feel like most people were like, it's good, but it's not as good as the first. I will say that they are jaded, and that it's a great film.
Okay.
I really like it. I thought it was good. And I love the first one. I get it's not as good as the first one, but how can it be? Because it's so much about the whole what the fuck's going on.
Hmm. The first one was a lot of that just built, like, finding out how it is that they're living their lives.
Yes.
In this horrific situation. And then I would have to assume in the second one, they're like, okay, well, now how do we get some resolution to the situation that they are in?
Yes.
And
did you see the first one?
I did. I really liked it. You saw the first one, so
you kind of know what's up.
Yeah.
Yeah. The second one, it literally picks up. They could be one film if you stitched them together from that point right there. Like, it ends the exact it begins at the exact second the last one ended.
Mm.
And for what it's worth, this one ends at a place where they could make another one if they felt so
inclined. Okay, oh, good franchise here.
Yeah, yeah. One long it's like that fucking show, 24, where it's okay. Like every episode has to be an hour. I digress. I think it's good. And they do this thing in this one where you actually do kind of get a taste of how it all went down initially, because I guess maybe was sort of this curiosity from anyone that watched the first one. I don't feel like you needed to see what happened to make it all, to make them to that point, but it gives you a bit of a flashback. And you can see what it was like for the last few moments before society was completely destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Of how kind of sweet and normal and simple everything was. You know, probably how people felt, maybe fucking October of 2019.
Mm.
Without knowing what was coming right around the turn.
when Donald Trump was our worst problem.
Yeah, precisely. Man. You go. This movie, though, it is very good. You get to see some John Krasinski because he's in that first part. Okay. And then the other guy that gets brought in, who's like the biggest character in the whole thing, probably thereabouts, is his neighbor and friend of his kids, Cillian Murphy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. He
plays. Always nice to see him.
Yeah, he's just another one of those stragglers that managed to ride this thing out and has sort of carved out this, like, I'm safe here, but am I even living? Kind of thing going down.
Well, that's kind of the thing with, like, the premise. Like, once you... I suppose we'll spoil the first one. Like, they're the aliens, and they're very hypersensitive to sound. If you make a sound, they will find you, they will kill you.
Yes.
So the first one's a lot of exploring, like, how it is that they're continuing, like, to live their lives, how it is they communicate with each other, how it is they gather resources and are able to maintain an existence. And then they discover the weakness. So, kind of the way that you build drama with these sort of, like, multi-part things is, like, now you have to find a situation that you can put your characters in that's going to be worse than what they were in the first time.
Yeah. And they did that by choosing to conceive a child.
Mm.
Like, that's kind of the one thing that's frustrating, is just that in and of itself has to be the worst decision that they could have made, was to be like, okay, let's... I don't think you even establish it. It's like, one, we should make damn sure we're practicing safe sex.
Uh-huh.
And because if the idea was that they were going to bring in a child having just lost a child, and babies make sound. Babies sure make a lot do. Of sound.
They don't shut, like, the fuck up.
That's the thing that they do.
Until they're 18, they just keep on yapping.
Right? Like, they're lucky that they've got these kids currently that are old enough to have, like, some self-discipline to not make noise. You know?
I hope my kids are brooding teenagers. At least they'll leave me alone.
Right. Oh, man. It's just, it's a mess. That whole setup. And it is, and again, I think that's part of what people complain about, is that a lot of these seem like kind of forced scenario. Like, they need that kid there because, of course, the kid's going to make noise. Mm. And
how you're establishing tension. If everyone knows, don't make a sound, then you need to have some sort of element in there that's like, well, we can't help it if this thing's going to make a sound.
Yeah, bingo. But other than that, I think this is a tight little horror film. It keeps going with what it does. And again, credit this movie. I would recommend you watch it. And you can't see it. It's not in the theater anymore. But, like, this is one of those ones where you need to be in a quiet room to just hear the movie. Mm. This is one of those movies where it will work its best if you devote your focus to it. It's not one of those ones having it on in the background while you're thumbing through your phone or something. Right. Like, there are a lot of movies that are fine for that. This is not one of those movies.
Gunpowder Milkshake.
Yeah, bingo. Hey, there you go.
It might be better if you're looking at something else while you're watching it.
Yeah, just go through that cast, pick any character, and you'll find a bunch of better movies that they've been in and the movies that they've already made.
Get out your DS. Start playing some Gen 4 Pokemon before the remake comes out.
Oh,
while you watch Gunpowder Milkshake.
You know, you gotta live a little.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good way to do it. Gosh.
Anything else about A Quiet Place 2?
No, it's good. People should watch it.
I do have one last... not a movie, but a miniseries that I watched. I watched A White Lotus, which is HBO Max original. Mm-hmm. So it's the only place to see it, unless they decide to do some sort of physical release for it one day. This is a... you remember the movie Forgetting Sarah Marshall?
Sure do.
A similar setup, or maybe a similar premise. Like, it's a bunch of people who are on vacation in a hotel in Hawaii, and it's kind of... you get this colorful cast of characters from people who are there on vacation, people who there work at the hotel, and they all have, like, different relationships and interactions with each other that often are pretty humorous. The show is silly at times. It's not afraid to be silly. It's also not afraid to, like, have these general moments of emotion and tension either. And I think that's why I really like it, is because it doesn't feel like there's one particular thing that the show has to be. If something is very serious or debaucherous or just plain, like, slapstick silly, it will allow itself to be those things and just move on to something else. It doesn't necessarily have to, like, okay, well, this show is a comedy, so we have to end every scene with a joke. It will, and really, like, the show is very cynical. Because you have this cast of characters, and there are maybe one or two of them who are actually, like, redeemable, who by the end you're like, oh, good, I'm glad good things happened.
Steve Zahn? Is he a good guy?
Steve Zahn is trying real hard to be a good guy.
Yeah.
And this show does touch on a lot of social and economic and political issues. And one of the things, like, Steve Zahn is there with his wife, who's this very successful internet mogul, and their kids are there with them, and the college-age daughter has brought a friend with her, and they're these two, like, very judgmental young adults. And they're also, like, it's a very cynical view of sort of, like, a woke culture, mm-hmm. where there's, like, these very, like, social justice conscious characters. They are very quick to point out the hypocrisy of a sort of a privileged class which they belong to, or at least the daughter of the family belongs to. I'm not so sure about the friend. But the show is also not afraid to, or even eager at some points to, sort of point out the hypocrisy of those two characters. Like, they say these things, but they don't actually do anything about them. They're on the vacation with the rich family as well. They are benefiting from the privilege while they're at the same time judging it.
The height of hypocrisy.
Yeah, which, you know, I think maybe inadvertently, but even if it's inadvertent, it doesn't make it, you know, necessarily excusable. The show is sort of dismissive about a culture that's striving for more social justice than by judging these two characters this way. It's just sort of like, okay, everyone who is part of this woke culture is like these two, who are benefiting from the structure of society even as they're judging it. And I don't necessarily think that's the case.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to Steve Zahn. He is, of course, a upper-middle-class white guy. And, you know, there he has a couple of frank conversations with his daughter and her friend about a sort of privileged class. And, you know, he is the type of guy who, you know, will still seem like he's trying his best, but then will always end up like, well, what am I supposed to do? Give him my privilege and my money? Well, I mean, how much money do you have? Because maybe.
Yeah. Again, that's like that expression, like, don't hate the player, hate the game.
Mm.
You know, if someone gets that rich, that's society's problem for allowing it, not that person for having done it.
Right.
As long as it's not, like, terribly illegal, you know.
It's true. It's not illegal to get that to be that rich, but, you know.
I mean, like,
I'm gonna go
Jeff
back.
Bezos, like, really committed a crime? Like, he's not, like, a gangster, you know. I'm sure that, you know. Okay, go ahead. You feel like you're chambering a thought here.
None that we know of.
None that we know of. There's a clear delineation between someone like a Jeff Bezos versus someone like a Jeffrey Epstein.
Mm.
Obvious, horrible human being, and glad he's dead. Well, he probably didn't kill himself.
Yeah, you know, like a Jeffrey Epstein, like, not going to miss that guy.
Right.
As opposed to, like, a Jeff Bezos, like, Jeff, maybe treat your employees a little bit better and also pay some fucking taxes, bro.
Yes.
But
yeah, like, all of these CEOs that enrich themselves, like, it's the game. If it wasn't them, it'd be somebody else.
Right. And we have a responsibility as a working class too. So, like, hey, we should be holding more political power because there are more of us. So if we want you to be less rich, guess what? We can do that. Yep. We can legislate. Mm-hmm. Which we should, and that goes back to the question, like, how much money do you have? Because maybe you should have less of it. Maybe we should take some of that money and, I don't know, build a school or give some people some health care.
Absolutely.
Because
that's a much better application of the money that America has, because it has a lot of it.
Doesn't need
to give all of it to just a handful of people.
You don't need all of those billions to go to space. You could have paid some taxes and still gone to space. You'd been fine.
Totally.
But anyway, that's not what the show is about.
You're telling me White Lotus is not about that.
No, well, I mean, there are a lot of explorations and discussions, and not just, like, outright dialogue, but explorations of ideas of class and privilege and ways that having, especially economic privilege, affects your sort of outlook on things. It becomes, like, a very self-indulgent, like, harder to look outside of yourself when you have things that you're trying to protect like that. But, you know, at the same time, well, it's having a very cynical view of a lot of different sides, you know, it's still also, like, silly.
Yeah.
There are fun moments. There are some really, there's really mean shit that happens too. But it's 6 episodes. I think it's well worth a watch. It's fun. And you get like some really human stuff too. Like almost no one. Almost no one is like entirely corrupt. Like everyone has like some good moments between all the characters. Like Steve Zahn and his son, they take scuba diving lessons together, and like they're able to connect as father and son on a level that they hadn't before through like a series of events and circumstances. Like there's some cool stuff there. And like in the son is one of like the more empathetic characters, because like he's got a pretty typical like sibling relationship with his older sister, and she just like tortures the shit out of him. Yeah. This poor kid, like she forces him to sleep in the sort of like kitchen area of the room, and in this particular hotel room it's like a closed kitchen, like a galley kitchen. And there's no ventilation in there, so they close the door and he's in there without any sort of airflow.
Oh, God.
So he eventually just goes and sleeps outside for the rest of the vacation. Like, jeez. And it, like, the tide comes in and it ruins his switch. You're like, oh, God, no, not the switch. Ah, oh, the humanity. But, yeah. So, I don't know. So I was watching the show and I was texting Daz at the same time. Hey, would you ever go scuba diving? And she went, no, too scary.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but scuba diving's not... Well... Yeah, I guess it could be kind of scary.
I think that's one of those, like, not scuba diving itself. I think scuba diving is relatively safe and harmless affair. It's cave diving. I don't know how anybody could decide that this is a hobby.
Hell
this
no.
This is just torture.
Nope.
Like, who does that? Nope. Who does that? Who's the fucking psychopath that is willing to go fucking cave diving?
Now, like, I'm okay with, like, walking into a cave. But, like, any sort of, like, cave diving situation you see, like, in movies or on TV, it always ends up with, like, okay, now we got to get through this narrow tunnel.
Yeah.
And that's at that point, I'd be like, no, I'm leaving. I'm turning around. And if this is the only way out, I choose death. Because we're going to die in there.
Uh-huh.
No. Like, that movie, The Descent.
Oh, yeah. That's
horrifying.
Yeah.
Horrifying movie. I couldn't get to the end.
Well, October approaches, man. Like we get to watch a bunch of horror films.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Oh, James Wan has a new movie out. My friend put it up on the Plex called Malignant.
Yeah, that's on. Yeah. I was gonna watch that one. That one looks good.
Mm-hmm.
But to close out the show.
Yeah.
I do have top 10 scary things you see when scuba diving.
Do you seriously have that?
I do. I have the written because I ended up texting. I ended up texting Des and like just sending her like dumb shit. Like, oh yeah, here's something you see when you're scary when you're scuba diving.
We don't get to do this Family Feud style where I get to guess what's on the list.
I mean, if you want. Or you just interject. This is enough to be a top 10. You could just come up with lots of scary shit that you see.
I mean, I would think of what, Cthulhu, number one.
Cthulhu, yeah.
Seeing Cthulhu. That's pretty horrifying. That'd be pretty shitty.
I'm going to start from, like, least scary things and work with the most scary things. Sharks.
Sharks.
Some sharks.
Obvious answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Your own corpse from the future. That's got to be a terrifying one.
Warming ocean waters. Pretty horrifying thing that you're going to see when scuba diving.
Yeah.
It's going to kill us all.
That's
that
true.
Global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Sea turtles who are up to something.
Yeah. They can be menacing and, you know, you get a group of them together and they're planning.
Oh, yeah. If you, like, if they, like, glance over at you and then swim away, you know that, those turtles are... And they live forever. They never die.
Well, you hear them, and they're going and going and going, and then they notice you're there, and they just all suddenly stop.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And then they just stare at you and wait for you to leave. You know, this is what they do.
Yep. A shifty starfish.
Oh, yeah, you don't want that.
Nope. They don't need brains.
They regenerate their limbs.
Yeah.
You can cut off one, and it creates a new starfish.
Right.
Like, that's... No. That's horrible.
Right. And imagine if one of them had an agenda. Like, yeah. We'd all be dead.
Oh, have you seen the new Death... Was it Death Squad? No, what is it called?
Suicide Squad.
Suicide Squad.
Yeah, yeah.
The main villain at the end of it was a starfish.
Right. Which is a weird turn, I thought.
God, that movie was so stupid.
I thought it was really silly, and I thought it was really fun. Me and Des watched it, really liked it. Yeah. But, God, like, it was so weird because, like, you thought, like, okay, now this movie's going to turn... They have to rescue the thing because it's a poor creature, sentient creature being tortured. And then it, like, breaks out. It's like, oh, I'm going to destroy everything now. Which I guess, like, you had to do. You had to have some sort of big bad in a superhero movie. Because it wasn't Peter Capaldi.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's just so odd that, like, you're supposed to, like, feel sympathy for this thing that is trapped. And then all of a sudden, like, oh, by the way, I'm going to murder everyone now.
Yeah, it's like the whole setup. That's what they do with everything. Mm. Anything you're supposed to care about just gets dismantled.
Right. It was why, like, all of the like, sort of perceived heroes, I guess the people you're supposed to be rooting for, the people working for the U.S. government, are even more despicable than the murderers that they're showing on the screen. Because...
Yeah, true. Oh, they have kind of a redemptive arc, I guess.
Right, they have the redemptive arc, but the main Amanda Waller, the ringleader, is
she's a bad person.
Yeah, the most irredeemable person on screen.
Mm-hmm. All right, back to the list.
Yep, number six, some rude coral.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't want it to be. I bet you it's the coral that's been bleached.
Mm.
I bet you that they're the ones that where it's like there's too much pH in here. Let me take it out on you.
You can't swim here.
Yeah, right?
Go away.
Mm-hmm.
Number five, a squid with a cleaver.
Yeah, that's pretty terrifying.
Terrifying, because you know he's going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Number four, a squid with eight cleavers.
That's also extremely terrifying.
Because it's got all those appendages. One of them's its penis,
mm-hmm.
and it's got a cleaver in it. And Des really likes octopus. For some reason, I find them horrifying creatures. Like, they're really creepy to me.
Do you know the only solid part on an octopus is its beak?
I've heard that.
So as they can move through anything that is at least as big as its beak.
Yep.
Fuck. No.
They might be aliens. I don't know if they're from this planet.
Yeah.
But like,
there's actually this evolutionary thing where everything becomes crab. Like, on a long enough timeline, everything becomes a crab.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I'm not going to do this any justice because it was so fascinating a topic. But it was talking about branching evolutionary paths, and that there's a bunch of different species that were that started by shifting out into other things, and then just eventually, not because they became extinct, but just became crabs again. Like, okay. Everything just decided to become crabs. I got it, it's fucked up. But yeah, there you go.
Wonder why crabs. Anyway,
they're little tanks.
Well, like squids, fucking an octopus, like they're supposed to be these highly intelligent creatures, which makes them even scarier. But like when they go to greet someone, if they're like willing to greet a person, they'll like reach out. But what they reach out with is always their dick appendage, and it looks just like their other arms.
Yeah.
But like I don't know how they found this out, but like it's always like getting ready to fuck you, person in a scuba suit who's just looking for a visit.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, a porpoise that will deny your bank loan application.
Oh, ain't that the worst?
Yep.
Who do they think they are? Like, I mean,
I think they're better than
I don't want to get into the conspiracies about it, but you know that the porpoises control the banks.
Mm. And you know, they're again, supposed to be highly intelligent creatures, and once they're able to establish a bureaucracy, I think we're all fucked.
No, absolutely.
Number two, an unvaccinated crab.
So, like, crabs themselves, terrifying animals.
Right?
Right.
And we will all become them someday, apparently.
And yeah, that's going to happen, right? Yeah. But unvaccinated? Why do you think choose not to get vaccinated, or do you think that they're just...
I think they're total. Like, if you're not a vaccinated crab, you're not, like, hesitant. You're, like, a denier.
Yeah.
Oof. And number one, scariest thing you see when scuba diving, a Holocaust-denying blowfish.
Oh, that's rough.
Yep.
You know, and like, I get it. The Holocaust occurred very little in the water, but...
Undeniable. That's a fact.
Right? I don't know. I just think there's no place in society today for any kind of blowfish that wants to be that way about it.
Right, right. You acknowledge history.
Yeah. Okay, so I've got a couple
that
I think are important.
Yes.
Male seahorses.
Uh-huh.
Not the female seahorses, the male seahorses, because they've got the gall... the unmitigated guthra to go over there and tell the women that they are the ones that are going to give birth.
Mm.
Right? Like, how snooty is that? Like, totally not even letting the women have that. That's the thing that women do.
Right.
Is to have the babies. And they steal it from them. Also, that there's not actual, that at the center of the earth is more water. I think it's terrifying to know that that's the true reality. And that it's not like solid earth at the core. There is no magma core.
Is that true?
It's all water. Water connects everything. Yeah, we're just... All of the continents are just floating atop this giant pool of water. A lot of people don't know that. It's a fact. I swear to God.
No. That can't be real.
It's a conspiracy theory. Same way that there is a hollow Earth,
right.
There is also this belief that at the core, at the center of the Earth, it is just more water.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Absurd.
Yeah. It's a thing, you know.
Hmm.
And also the largest mountain, if you exclude water, is in Hawaii.
Oh, interesting.
Fun fact.
So the largest, the tallest mountain from... Like the core of the Earth too.
Yes. What is it? Because the largest mountain in our solar system is actually on Mars.
Right. Which is a smaller planet.
Yes. But that's because there's no water. So therefore, we if it had water, we would not see such a massive peak. There'd be
sea level.
Yeah. So I think the Elder Gods, terrifying. You don't want the Elder Gods in the water. That's got to be a really shitty experience. I think just...
Is that because Hawaii is closer to the equator, so it's a greater distance from...
I think it's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Interesting.
Which is the largest ocean on Earth.
Uh-huh.
Right? Yeah. So I think that there's just some really deep trenches or whatever you want to call them that are on both sides of it. And that if you were to go to those low points and then see it, how they spike up to just barely get out of the water. You've got a very large mountain.
So it's not like... tallest in elevation from sea level, but if you were like to take it from the base of where it started up to the top of it, that is a greater distance than from like the base of Everest to the top of Everest.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think so. A couple of do you know the term for the fear of the ocean or for the fear of large bodies of water?
No,
it's called thalassophobia.
Okay.
And yeah, it is absolutely genuinely terrifying. Also, I think the scariest thing, and I think about this whenever I'm on a cruise ship, is the idea that if I were to fall overboard, they would never find me. Mm. I would not be found. I would die. And I wouldn't die immediately. I would take hours of exhaustion. And they also say that you can kind of float on your back and not expend. And then you just suffer the terrible indignity of living for a day before you die.
Mm.
You know? Like, what a horrible way to go.
Yeah, drown, like... Any way to go in the ocean, like drowning, is horrifying.
Trapped under ice, that's got to be a tough way to do it.
Yep.
Yeah.
They're not going to dig you up a century later and make you a superhero. That's not going
to
happen.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that could, in theory, happen. Was that, who has that happened to?
Captain America. Of course, I think he was a superhero before.
That was Bucky.
It might have been Bucky.
I don't know, maybe
they did it twice.
I watched the first episode of that Marvel What If
thing. Uh-huh.
And it was, the premise was like, what if, I guess there was a British woman that... he was palling around with.
Oh, sure. Agent Carter?
Yeah, what if she was the one that ended up getting the super serum?
Played by Hayley Atwell in the movie?
Yeah.
The tremendous Hayley Atwell.
That's nice. I was hoping that when they said that they were going to spin the series off, that it was going to be Emily Van Camp's character.
Sure.
She was the other one. But
yeah, yeah.
Hey, yeah, no, that's neither here nor is
the,
it there.
The niece of the lady that he made out with.
Yeah.
That he then made out with.
Oh, good man. That's Steve Rogers. He really knows what he's doing.
Really stand-up guy.
He's figured it out. No. Okay. That's a good list. I kind of like your list. You know? And it's sharks. Sharks in general.
Mm-hmm.
Just there.
Any kind. Any of them.
Yeah.
All predators. All killers.
Yeah, they are.
Perfect killing machines. They've been doing it for millennia.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's what they say about alligators. Mm-hmm. That they're...
dinosaurs.
Evolutionarily unchanged. Because they just haven't needed to. You know? If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
We were at a... oh, God. When was this? We must have still been on quarantine. This must have been sometime last year. But Dez's mom... No, it couldn't have been last year. But anyway, there's like this touristy type thing. It's kind of like a diet Gatorland place.
What?
Yeah, which is a weird sentence to say, because Gatorland is like this RC Cola of a theme park.
Gatorland is something that lets you, that if someone brings it up, you know they're from Florida.
Yeah,
because it's the theme park that we Floridians go to, where we know we don't have to worry about other tourists.
It's not a tourist trap. No one's coming here and being like, oh yeah, put Gatorland on the list. It's like Disney, Universal, SeaWorld, kill ourselves, and then five things down, Gatorland.
Yeah.
But It's this diet Gatorland, and we went there, and like they had like animal encounter, like you'd hold a spider and a snake, and then like they had this thing where like they were feeding gators, and the lady was this young lady, she must have been, she was like 18 or 19. She was feeding these gators, like holding some chicken and like calling them over the water. Like she'd have them chain, like they would jump out of the water. She'd drop the chicken, she'd grab it, and Ripley sees this, and we don't even notice her doing it. But we're standing on a bridge, a good ways away from where she's doing the feeding, and Ripley then like reaches her hand out over the water because she wants to call an alligator too. And this happened months ago. To this day, like I'll wake up in sweats because I like. Have these pictures in my mind of Ripley, of like an alligator coming up and trying to grab something out of Ripley's hand, and like and the lady who's doing the feeding, she's like, hey, maybe don't let her. We looked down like, holy shit, and like pulled her back, cause no, they'll eat her arm and not give a fuck. They're dinosaurs.
That they are. Jeez.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Let's do a retro show next time. Retro show?
Yeah, we got to catch up on stuff, right?
Yeah, we really do.
August was a big month for stuff, I feel like, and then September not a whole lot happened.
Okay,
there's only one movie I thought was even worth talking about, and there's not a lot of good music that came out that month for
me. What was the movie in September?
Best in Show.
Oh yeah.
Which one. Stars oh my gosh, I had the list here. Actor Jennifer Coolidge.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer Coolidge is in your show
White Lotus.
Yeah.
Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara, not in White Lotus, but also in that movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it's and maybe we'll get into it when we actually do the show. Probably one of the more like well recognized Christopher Guest movies. For good reason, it's fun. But I think like the fact that it has dogs in it is what people are like. Oh yeah, I love that movie. It's got the dogs and the silly people in it.
Oh man, yeah.
But I got Christopher Guest like. That's kind of his bread and butter, is he makes those mockumentaries with like the same cast of characters.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it then. I think that it's kind of overlooked how critical that was to literally all of the popular sitcoms right now.
Mm.
Like The Office or Parks and Rec has the exact same format.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's so many popular shows now. Modern Family uses that interview-style mockumentary thing where you're filming them as they're doing it, even though there's no justification for why it's being filmed.
Yep. Well, again, and so many other things. Like, if you go back to Spinal Tap and the way, like, now that, like, music is used for humor in a lot of things. Like a lot of the South Park and, like, all the stuff that kind of spun out of that with the Team America and Book of Mormon, how they use music to sort of, like, have this irreverent... a mocking of their subject matter.
Yeah.
But anyway.
We'll save that for the retro show.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. That's the end. Till next time.
All right. Bye-bye. So long. Gotta get that in there.